Good morning, Ms. Sander.
I represent Cornelius Price. Mr. Price was convicted in the district court of bank robbery occurring on the date of October the 2nd, 2002, in the Northern District of Illinois, and of carrying a firearm in relationship to a crime of violence, which in this case, the crime of violence was the bank robbery. He received a lengthy sentence of 410 months. Mr. Price's convictions should be reversed. This morning, Mr. Price seeks reversal on two grounds. First, evidence of a conviction for a later bank robbery occurring on March the 11th, 2003, was improperly admitted at trial in violation of Rules 404B and 403. Second, after Mr. Price was arrested on this later bank robbery, he made a statement to the agents that that was the only bank robbery he had ever committed. The defense sought introduction of this statement at the time of trial to explain his statements in an interview to the very same agents regarding the October 2 bank robbery while he was serving his time for the later one on March the 11th, 2003.
Seems to me that there are a number of similarities between the two bank robberies.
I wish to address those.
And in weighing the number of similarities, and the district judge actually did that here and found that the similarities were so present here that it would allow, as I guess was modus operandi or something, to come in and have the jury hear. What do you see as dissimilar between those two bank robberies?
What I see as dissimilar is this. The bank robbery that is before this court, the October 2nd, 2002 bank robbery, was a very sophisticated, complicated bank robbery. There were four participants. Two of the participants rushed the bank teller or employee at the door. They had firearm. They took the employee in. They had the employee turn on lights, deactivate the alarm. After they obtained the money, they left the bank. They had walkie-talkies. They had a getaway car set up across the street. They had a lookout car set up elsewhere so that there were really four people that engaged in this robbery, and the whole thing had been planned in detail. In contrast to that, we have this little robbery that Mr. Price had done on March the 11th, 2003, in which he alone went into a bank. Now, this, granted, was an early morning robbery. So this is also another situation of rushing the teller at the front door.
That's pretty unusual, isn't it?
Well, it isn't unusual.
It's not unusual?
It's not unusual. I mean, the government's brief has made that very clear, that this is pretty much the common modus operandi of an early morning bank robbery.
Well, of an early morning bank robbery, you usually come in early in the morning. But,
It's a situation where the teller or the bank employee has to be met at the door because that's the person that's opening the bank. Sure. Obviously, there aren't going to be issues of robbing tellers at the counter because there aren't going to be any tellers in the counter. So then we have the person that's there opening the bank. That person is obviously going to have to turn on the lights. They're going to have to deactivate the alarm.
Of 100 bank robberies, what percentage of them are done that way, where you lay in wait for someone to come to open the bank in the morning and then you rush in with that person? That's what happened in both of these. I think that's pretty unusual, and I would think out of 100 bank robberies, very rare that it would happen like that, and if two of them happen like that,
okay. Well, first of all, to respond to what the court is asking, there is evidence within this case showing that there are other participants that are associated with these Hill brothers who apparently put these together, who did very similar robberies. There is the problem that Mr. Price is singled out as an individual that did this robbery when we know full well from even the evidence within the case pertaining to the October 2nd, 2002 robbery that there are other individuals in that case, in other robberies charged in that case, who are doing exactly the same thing. Our concern is that given the fact that this type of robbery happens to be done in a certain manner of having to meet the teller or the employee at the door and then go in and basically have the employee turn on the bank and get the money from the vault or wherever the money is kept, I don't believe that that really establishes that sort of idiosyncratic similarity. That means that if Mr. Price also did another bank robbery in a whole other area outside the city of Chicago, that we are supposed to assume that that is so close that in similarity that it is probative enough in light of the very prejudicial value of bringing that into the case. And that is our real concern here. I mean, these types of robberies, if a robbery is going to be done in that fashion at the door, then I think that we're going to find a situation where anybody who's doing that type of robbery is going to be doing it in that fashion. Time's going. Thank you.
Okay. Mr. Cornino.
Reed Cornea for Vincent Hamilton. May it please the court, counsel. Vincent Hamilton was convicted in a jury trial of participating in an armed bank robbery. Specifically, he was the getaway driver. And in addition to that, he was found to be in possession of a firearm. Although the firearms themselves were actually located under the car seat of the van, and not necessarily in his possession. Physical possession. I want to start off with Santiago and the introduction of some co-conspirator statements. To allow co-conspirator statements, as the court's aware, the government has to show by a preponderance of evidence that a conspiracy existed and that the defendant and the declarant were part of that conspiracy. Well, in this case, the statements that were introduced were not made in furtherance of the conspiracy. They were not made for recruitment purposes, and they were simply overheard statements by a co-conspirator who later, based on what he heard, approached another member, Eddie Hill, and asked if he could join the heist. And so,
Hamilton was present at that conversation, wasn't he?
Hamilton was present at the conversation, and as the transcripts clearly show from the testimony of the co-conspirator, he basically says, I overheard a conversation. Well, put it in a little more context, they were at a party where one of their friends had recently been released from incarceration. They were there just playing cards, drinking, having a good time. First off, in that context, there's a lot of bragging going on or you know, thumping of the chest.
Well, she had sense enough to put him out of the house so he could smoke marijuana in the garage.
The sister did, yeah. She didn't want her brother, who had just been released, to be sent back. But as the co-conspirator stated, he overheard this conversation between Eddie Hill and Mr. Hamilton, and the co-conspirator says it was mostly Hill speaking. Hamilton would, you know, interject occasionally, but mostly nodding his head. And so this was not a recruitment tool to bring in these co-conspirators. They overheard this conversation and then later came and approached and asked.
Now, of course, there was no objection at trial to the admission of the co-conspirator statement on as to Hamilton was there.
That's correct, Your Honor, and that's why.
So we've got to find plain error here.
Correct, Your Honor.
What a steep hill to climb.
It is a very steep hill to climb, but I think the effect of allowing these statements in without first determining whether they were even could be even corroborated by the government, which the government provided no evidence that, you know, newspaper articles, police reports, anything to corroborate these alleged heists that Mr. Hill was bragging about, suggests that they should not have been entered. And I think if you look at the prejudicial effect of allowing this, for the jury to hear that Mr. Hamilton had spoken or had admitted, you know, as it appears from the testimony of the co-conspirator, suggests strongly that, you know, that may have had an effect on his credibility when he testified, which I think is an important effect on the trial. I don't think that's harmless error. Whenever you're dealing with credibility of witnesses, harmless error doesn't come into play. And so, and that takes me to the next issue that I wanted to discuss that didn't deal with just remanding back for trial, but a sentencing issue. In this case, the government sought and the district judge allowed a 2-point enhancement for obstruction of justice. Now, this increased the upper limit of Mr. Hamilton's sentence. He ended up serving or being sentenced to more time because of this 2-point enhancement. Now, what concerns me about this is that this decision to enhance or to increase the upper limit based on this obstruction, the judge made no statements or fact-finding in regards to the elements of obstruction or perjury. And I think the Supreme Court in Buchanan...
I thought he found that he lied under oath.
He said he lied, but I think we need something a little more specific than that. Basically, what the... He didn't believe him. Correct. But I think in order to enhance a sentence by 2 points and increase the length, that just simply not believing them is a little bit... There needs to be more. There has to be specific instances described about what he didn't believe about him, other than just saying it was patently unreasonable. Which is what the district judge said. And I think that, in conjunction with 3553A and the guidelines, requires this to be remanded for resentencings at the very least, if not remanded for a new trial based on the...
Okay. Thank you. Mr. Pope.
Good morning. Turning first to Defendant Price's argument regarding... evidence introduced of the other bank robbery. As your honors are aware, the government introduced that evidence to prove modus operandi. And the case law is clear on that the evidence you need to prove that the evidence is sufficient, or the prior bank robbery and the circumstances of it were sufficiently idiosyncratic to permit the jury to make an inference of a pattern. And that's exactly what you have here. You have in each case, and the judge took that, understood that law, and also understand that you don't define it so broadly that it would allow anything to be that. And the judge said it doesn't have to match point for point, but there are unique things here, sufficiently unique things here. The method of entry, the early morning, confronting at the door with a gun to the back of the head, is unique. It's borne out by the statistics that the government cited in its brief. Of all of the robberies in, I think, 2005, the 5.4% of them involved accessing the vault area anyway. Now, unfortunately, the FBI statistics don't break that down any further. But what a review of the case law shows is that these bank robberies are very, very rare. I think it was 5 cases in published cases in the Seventh Circuit, which in that database I reran it this morning, and it goes back to the first case is 1927. So the first case from 1927 until today. There's 5 cases where people were confronted early morning armed takeover.
Frankly, the thing that surprises me is the access to the vault by one person.
The access to the vault by the one person?
Yeah.
The teller was able to access the vault?
Uh-huh. Or? Normally, and I don't know this for a fact all around, but they usually almost always have 2 people that have to access the vault for their own protection and everything else. That's beside the point, but that's an interesting statistic because the person who opens the bank can access the vault is surprised me.
You know, forgive me for interrupting, but Defendant Price says there's some factual inaccuracies in your brief. Is there anything that you believe you need to correct?
There's one mistake that I certainly did make, and that was regarding the distance between the two banks. And Defendant Price's counsel pointed out that it was 19.2 or 19.4 miles, and I had indicated that it was 5.4, or somewhere around 5. That's it. I don't think nothing else, and it doesn't change the analysis, because when you look at the unique method of entry into the bank, and then after that, what Defendant Price did in each case. Cooperator Jackson testified in October 2nd, 2002 robbery, the charged robbery. Defendant Price was the first one to the door. He was the first one to confront the teller, push him in with Eddie Hill behind him. After that, pushing in at gunpoint to the alarm, turn off the alarm, to the vault, open up the vault, produce a laundry bag that you brought with you for the money to go into, force the teller to put the money in the laundry bag. All of that, the judge weighed that, saw that, the statistics bear it out, that is a very, very unique method of bank robbery, and certainly the district court did not abuse its discretion in admitting it as such.
Do you think we could take a minute to talk about the admission of Eddie Hill's car purchase records? Because I have a hard time picturing what kind of business record could ever be inadmissible when I read your argument, because this didn't sound like a business. It sounded like a criminal enterprise. In other words, what I've been trying to figure out is how the government can call this regularly conducted business activity when the government indicted the dealership and employees, you know, for fraud and racketeering. And I really have trouble thinking of a less reliable business record than the records of a business that engages in fraud and racketeering.
Yes, Your Honor. The business records, what the business records showed, and certainly that business was indicted, as was the custodian of records who put those records into evidence in this trial. What those business records showed is that and Ramona Rodriguez testified to, was that it was the practice of the company to, when they sold the vehicle, to fill out the appropriate paperwork, and that a person, sometimes they put it in other people's names, without a doubt. You know, no different than if a father were to buy a car for their daughter. It could be their daughter's car, but the father could put in a name.
I'm saying is that these aren't business records, because the last part of Rule 8036 would have no meaning if this, you know, simply goes to the weight, because that part of the rule states that business records are admissible unless the source of the information or the circumstances of the preparation indicate a lack of trustworthiness. And here, the circumstances of preparation are highly suspect, and I'm trying to figure out how the court admitted the car purchase records for Hill.
Well, Your Honor, what the evidence showed was that, and the testimony showed, was that a person named Eddie Hill was present, that Eddie Hill presented an ID with his picture on it in his name when that car was purchased, that a 2000 Jaguar was sold to a person with Eddie Hill present, that the car cost at least $20,000, and that at least $8,000 in cash was put down. It's sufficiently reliable to that point, and the testimony established that the car may have cost more than that in order to hide and avoid the CTR, the cash transaction reporting requirements, over $10,000, both for the business's benefit and for Eddie Hill's benefit in this particular case, so that they didn't have to report that and explain how they got more than $10,000 cash.
Let me ask you this. One of the car records was about the Ford Explorer, and that was allegedly purchased by Price the day after the October 2nd robbery.
Yes, sir.
And a Ford Explorer was found I think by pretty good police work after the March 03 robbery, we're walking around and
pressing the button,
and pretty soon, boy, a Ford Explorer responded to that button. Was there testimony that was the same Ford Explorer that was in the purchase records from October 3rd?
Yes, there was. The agent testified to it, and he also testified to the statement that defendant Price gave after the March 11th, 2003 robbery when he was arrested. And in that statement, they asked him about the car. Where did you get this car? And he ultimately admitted, I bought this last October, and he gave an address that an intersection, and the address escapes me at this moment, but that was right on, exactly where the car dealership was located, that the car records were introduced for defendant Price. Exactly. Turning finally to defendant Hamilton's argument.
Can I ask one question about Price, regarding the sentencing? I wasn't quite clear about the consecutive issue they were arguing about. Say it was consecutive to something. Was it the gun part that was consecutive, or was he in prison for something else and it was consecutive to that?
He had already pled guilty to and was sentenced for the March 11th, 2003 robbery before this trial.
was he in prison?
I believe 125 or 126 months with respect to that. And at sentencing in this case, the district court judge calculated the guidelines, then sentenced him on the bank robbery, and since this was his second 924C conviction, made the 25 years required by the statute there consecutive to the bank robbery in this case, so it's giving a 410-month sentence. And then the district court did impose that 410 months consecutive to the 125 that he was already serving, giving an effective sentence of 535.
Okay, that's what I wanted to clarify. Thank you.
Turning finally to defendant Hamilton's argument regarding 404B, it's very quickly. The defendant can't show plain error in this case. With respect to the Santiago or the co-conspirator statements, the case law is crystal clear on this. Recruiting statements, planning statements made to get people to join a conspiracy are well-established co-conspirator exceptions to the hearsay rule. In addition, as Judge Rovner pointed out, it's a tough road to hoe in this case because of the overwhelming evidence against defendant Hamilton in this case. And the introduction of those two statements, or the challenge statements, in no way would have affected the outcome of this case. Thank you.
Okay, thanks. Let's see. You've got how much time? You got 2 minutes. 2 minutes, Mrs. Emder.
Your Honors, briefly. We believe that sum total of evidence in this case does not show that the fact of the robbery on March the 11th, 2003, to which Mr. Price pled guilty, is the type of robbery that clearly distinguishes him from other offenders who commit that same kind of bank robbery. I mean, the whole point of what we're saying is these early morning robberies are all similar in that regard. It does not specifically distinguish Mr. Price. And if you were to take out proof of that robbery and look at what you have left in this case, you have nothing but Cleve Jackson, who just has a string of problems behind him as to his motivation to testify. You have these questionable records, and even as to Mr. Price, you have this additional problem that he never does anything with that car for 6 months. And we know from Mr. Jackson, from Cleve Jackson's testimony, that people who were buying these cars were not necessarily the people who were using them, which left open the whole issue of were the bank robbers buying these cars? Were other people buying them for bank robbers? What was going on? There never was any testimony on that particular subject. And then you have this ambiguous statement by Mr. Price, which did not clearly say that he had committed the robbery. It said he was willing to cooperate. And the whole issue at trial was left open of what did he mean by cooperate? Was he just saying he would provide the names and information of the people who participated in the robbery? And it was known that he knew the Hill brothers. He did know them. And he obviously was in a position to have known and had been given information about who participated in that robbery. But by saying that he was provide information did not mean he was saying he was a participant. And the agent was very carefully questioned on this subject at trial, and he acknowledged that Mr. Price never at all acknowledged that he was a participant, that he had shared in any proceeds, that he had even been at the bank on that day. Thank you.
Thanks very much. Cornelia, you have 1 minute.
Just in quickly, the conversation that was overheard by the co-conspirator was not directed towards him, not part of recruitment, and therefore should not have been allowed to come in. It was not part of the conspiracy. I mean, on first reading of the transcript, this topic just popped right out of the transcript for me. Should it have been objected to? Yes. Should Mr. Price be able to have a full and fair trial? Yes. This evidence goes directly to the weight that the jury most likely gave his testimony, and I think, therefore, the introduction of this evidence requires a new trial. Thank you.
Okay, thanks.